That's true. Okay, I'm going to call to order this meeting of the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. Today is February 3rd, 2017. We are meeting today, colleagues, for our one and only Friday meeting starting next week. Members of the audience, this committee will meet on Thursday from 1 to 3 instead of Friday from 3 to 5. If you're curious about the reason for that, just think about it for a moment.
Nobody's here. Okay.
So on the agenda today, we have an informational hearing related to the latest report of the Global Warming Commission, which is hot off the presses, and we wanted to hear it as soon as possible because this is a subject, obviously, that we'll be coming back to a lot this session. So with that, I'm going to open this informational meeting, and it's my pleasure to bring up Angus Duncan and particularly Jessica Shipley.
How'd you suddenly get top billing?
Okay, Angus, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much. I'll come down and testify on any afternoon that Senator Roblin is handing out chocolate. Friday afternoon, Saturday afternoon.
Yeah, he took us out of that. It's always Friday, so yeah, just wiped that out.
It's a blow.
Sounds to me like payola.
That's right.
Yeah, but it's the right kind of payola.
Yeah.
So, Mr. Chairman, thank you very much for inviting us to come down and talk to you about our report, which, as you note, is, in fact, hot off the presses, was just posted, minutes ago. The commission considered it and adopted it unanimously earlier this week. And so we're happy to walk you through some of the more significant findings and recommendations.
Before you, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Before you go any farther, are you saying that this report is hot off the presses? Am I on the wrong report?
It's a draft.
This is just a draft?
Mm-hmm. This is the one with the cool cover art.
Okay.
But it is available.
It's now available on our website.
It is now available online, right. And as I said, I will walk you through the principal findings and recommendations. Should note for the record, my name is Angus Duncan. I am president of the Bonneville Environmental Foundation, and I am apparently the chairman for life of the Oregon Global Warming Commission, at least until I can find someone to succeed me in this. Whereas Jessica is the second staff person I have now worn out, and I'm going to have to start working on my third here soon. So, indeed. Mr. Chairman, the Global Warming Commission was set up according to legislation passed by the legislature in 2007. That makes this our 10th year anniversary. In those 10 years, we have seen some progress in meeting the goals that the legislature set for us, some notable achievements, but I have to say, on the whole, we are still falling far short of our aspirational goals, and at least so far we are largely unwilling to make them more than aspirational. We are also not very well organized to pursue those goals in a systematic fashion, and that's part of what we are trying to message to the legislature this year. So the recommendations, I will forego reading them to you, assuming you can do that yourself. But basically, transportation, forest carbon accounting, and some two recommendations on trying to reorganize the way the state sets and pursues its climate goals. The commission report itself is a six chapter, but pretty modest size document this time around. I'm going to ask Jessica if she will walk you through the data sets in the first chapter on our reduction goals, our inventory, and how we're doing on that, and then I'll come back to the recommendations.
Okay, before you do that,
yes.
Vice Chair Olson has a question.
On the page previous to this, and I haven't, you don't have to, well, there you go. Number four, do you have a dollar amount for sufficient resources? Have you put that together?
Yes, there is an LC draft, which will be introduced on the House side by Representative Helm and Representative Power, and on the Senate side, at least so far, by Senator Taylor. And we're hoping for another primary co-sponsor.
Can you elaborate on what's in it?
You bet.
Why don't we wait to get
yeah,
to that?
Yeah, we will actually.
Are you gonna, you're gonna
we
go
will
through.
We will get to it as. Wait a minute.
Is it in there?
Yes. Six.
Okay,
section six.
Yeah. If it's in there.
Yeah. Yep.
Great.
I just want to know what the dollar amount is.
Okay.
Hold yourself in suspense.
That's right. If I told you now, you could get up and leave.
Would be sweet.
All right, Chair Denbrough, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jessica Shipley. I'm with the Oregon Department of Energy, and I also provide staff support to the commission. I'm going to describe, as Angus said, some of the data that you'll find in this most recently published report on our greenhouse gas emissions inventory and also on our updated projection of what we expect our future emissions to be. So this slide is the greenhouse gas inventory. You may recognize it from previous commission reports. In this version, we have 2014 and 2015 data to add to the previous inventory that you've seen before. A couple of data points to note that Angus has included here. In 1999 is when Oregon's emissions were at their highest, at their peak, which was about 7 or 8 years prior to when the national emissions inventory peaked. We had another little mini peak in 2007, and then we saw declines in emissions every year until the last few years, where we've had mostly flat emissions, and then in 2015 we saw a reasonably sized uptick to about 63 million tons, largely driven by transportation.
I'm gonna have a ton of questions for you, so as you fly along, just watch my hand. I'll wait for you. The 2015 number, the 2014 number, are those estimates or are those actuals? Because we've never had them this fast.
Right.
That is, Senator Olson, that is correct. We are working very hard to make this timeline shorter between when the emissions data are reported to DEQ and when we can provide them in the greenhouse gas inventory. In 2014 and 2015, there are some numbers that are estimated and some that are actuals. Primarily, the agricultural sector numbers are estimated using an EPA tool that we have available to us. But we have actual emission reported data from utilities, transportation fuels, large industrial emitters, so natural gas utilities and natural gas pipelines. So we have a significant amount of reported data.
A follow-up question?
Please.
There was recently an article in the paper about TriMet, and they have not been playing fair with their biodiesel. Is that accounted for in your transportation numbers?
Senator Olson, I am not familiar with that that issue. I don't know whether it would be accounted for, but these are 2014 and 2015 numbers, so I'm not sure what year that issue was from.
TriMet has been allegedly, according to this report, fudging their numbers. They said they were using B20, and they weren't using B20. They were using B5 unbeknownst to anyone. All of us are new to this, and this was an investigative report, and so they've been doing this for 7 years, so I just wonder how that affects the numbers that they've been providing to you and what you're using. And I'm not saying that if they provide it to you, you would use it, assuming that they were telling you the truth. And so I just wanted to make certain that this was taken into account.
You bet. Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, it'd probably be fair to say we haven't taken that into account. As you observe, we were all assuming that when they said they were using a certain level of biodiesel, they were. And so we're a little bit surprised by that as well and a little bit dismayed. But I think we will find that any effect of that is so far to the right of the decimal point that it really is not going to have any effect on on our overall transportation emissions or our overall emissions. The light duty vehicles and the freight and rail and air vehicles, you know, just swamp transit emissions. And since most of the transit emissions are from diesel anyway, the relatively small number of biodiesel buses, you know, it still is a bad thing to do, and it's a good thing to fess up, but it's not going to make any visible impact on the transportation greenhouse gas numbers, I would predict.
Why don't we continue with this? But I guess, you know, one sort of core question is, do you, if you subsequently learn that there was misinformation for whatever reason, is there the capacity to go back and revise earlier numbers?
Yes, we do that all the time. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. And
it's a good point, but I'm trying to make the point of the fact that if there's 639 buses on the road putting out diesel fumes that aren't accounted for, mm-hmm. which would skew your numbers to a higher level, you know, I'm trying to make that point clear that are we dealing with the actual numbers? And
so, Senator Olson, you know, I'm speculating here, and I probably shouldn't, but I think we can go back to TriMet and just ask them for the numbers that they had earlier submitted and the revised numbers, and we'll put those into the transportation numbers, and we'll get you an answer back so that, you know, neither good. You nor I have to speculate here.
Sounds good.
Good. Thank you.
Great. Thanks. Jessica?
Let's see. I don't think I have much else to highlight on this slide, other than that the uptick in 2015 emissions is due, the majority of the increase came from the transportation sector. About 20% of that increase came from the residential and commercial sector.
Here's another question for you. Since we lost our shipping and we can't transport our product through shipping, and we've got a huge increase in volume in diesel trucks, would this account for the increase in your transportation side?
Senator Denbrough, Senator Olson, it would. The transportation sector numbers come from fuel suppliers, and so to the extent that there's an increase in fuel being brought into the state to supply whatever demand that may be, it would be reflected in this inventory.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. And Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, you're exactly right that the trucks, the overland trucks, are significantly less efficient in moving, you know, pounds and volume, you know, per gallon of diesel. Again, I think we will find that it is the light duty vehicles that the cars we drive and the small trucks that are the horse, and the freight change is the tail, and that it will make some difference, but it probably will not make a huge difference. The big impact here is in additional vehicle miles traveled overall, and which vehicles we're using to travel those additional miles. And I'll have a chart on VMT in a little bit, but if you can okay. Go back just a second, if you look at those numbers, one of the interesting things you'll see, and you'll see it also when we look just at transportation numbers, is, you know, we peaked in 1999. Our emissions started going down, at least in part as a consequence of the 2000-2001 recession. Most of our emissions kept going down, but our transportation emissions started rising again. You know, it hit a lesser peak and then started dropping again, you know, during and following the 2008 recession. And now we're seeing a rebound from that as people, particularly as people feel more able to drive, buy larger vehicles, drive more miles, and they're also seeing much less expensive diesel and gasoline at the pump. So that's what's really driving those transportation numbers.
Mr. Chair. Is there another driving factor, the increase in our population?
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, they talk about 112 folks in Portland a day. Mm-hmm. Do the math from 1990, that's a lot.
Yeah, and we actually, in our prior report, we had these numbers on a intensity basis, you know, per capita. And we're going to add those numbers into this report. We just haven't had a chance yet. But we do want people to be able to see that effect of population.
Great.
That chart is in the appendix, actually. So,
already?
Yep, it's in there.
There you go.
So this chart just gives you a snapshot of 2015, just another way of kind of slicing up our emissions inventory. It demonstrates the size of the transportation sector emissions, electricity use being the second largest source of emissions. And then what you're seeing with the others, residential and commercial and industrial, those are the emissions that remain after you remove electricity use and natural gas use from those two sectors. And then agriculture is roughly 8%, and that's pretty consistent across all years.
We got another one for you.
Okay.
In the agricultural sector, with the influx of marijuana grow operations, which are totally energy abusers, will you anticipate a growth in that sector?
Senator Olson.
Or will you put it in agriculture, or will you keep it under electricity?
In this chart, it would be under electricity use. But we in the previous chart, it would show up. We would disaggregate that out to the agricultural sector, so it would appear in that blue bar.
Okay.
Yeah. But I also expect that, and I'm not quite sure how we're going to do this, Senator Olson, but when we have a significant fleet conversion over to electric vehicles, we'll also have to make some kind of a decision about where to allocate the emissions associated with those vehicles, to electricity or to transportation. Probably we would do it to transportation, but it's an open question.
What is your assumption on the number of vehicles by 2035? Because we're a very small amount right now.
It's very small right now. And, you know, I actually had I had a couple of estimates of that, and I'm not sure that I have them in what I wrote down.
Why don't we hold off on that and get through the...
But I can also provide you with that. We'll start making notes here.
Okay, yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, so this chart is a little bit busy, but what you're seeing here in the blue dotted line is just the exact same greenhouse gas historical inventory that you saw two slides ago. And now to it, we've added our projection of Oregon's greenhouse gas emissions going out into the future. There's two projections on here. The orange line is from our last report, and the red line is our new projection. We're just showing you that to demonstrate sort of the effect of what we expect the impact of Senate Bill 1547 from last session, the coal to clean legislation, will be. Also, this is just a note. We changed the methodology that we used this time around, so that's why the orange and the red line are not exactly on top of each other out to 2030. But they're very close, which is means that the tools are very similar, which was a good thing. So basically, the key takeaway here is the gap between the yellow line and the red line is where we sort of expect our emissions will be above the state's 2020 and 2050 statutorily adopted greenhouse gas goals. And those estimates are also provided in the report.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Vice Chair.
Here we go again. I wasn't around then when this was going on, but when these statutorily adopted rates were put into effect, did they take into account the fact that we would have an abnormal increase in population? Because we've gone up from 1990 to now by 1.2 million people. So was that included? Was your statistical analysis included saying that all these people are going to move in, but they're not going to bring any carbon with them?
So, Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, I think the best answer to that is that if we're going to get a handle on greenhouse gas emissions, it has to be a handle on total emissions released, irrespective of population. Yes, more population generates more greenhouse gases, which means that our management and control methods have to be, you know, even more effective. But it's also, I think, worth noting that the city of Portland and Multnomah County, which have, you know, one of the best, most professional, best documented greenhouse gas reduction programs in the country, they have reduced greenhouse gas emissions in an absolutely, while their population has increased faster than any other part of the state. So it is possible to drive greenhouse gas emissions down. The atmosphere, unfortunately, doesn't care about tons of carbon dioxide per person or per dollar of GDP. It just cares about tons of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. So that has to be our target, notwithstanding population increases.
Well, follow up. Portland would be one of the largest producers of greenhouse gas, correct?
Yes.
Multnomah County?
Or yes.
Or do you look at the Tri-County area?
Portland looks at
Portland,
the city of Portland, Multnomah County.
Could you send me some figures to show me what they're doing?
Yep.
And how they're doing it? Thank you.
Okay. Okay, yeah, you get to start taking notes now. So,
I'm sorry. So, just the previous slide, the bottom line message is we're not on track.
The bottom line message is we are not on track. I think the secondary message, Mr. Chairman, is clearly we have done some things that gain ground. So this is not an impossible reach. It's just a highly challenging one. And we want to talk a little bit about, you know, where we go next to take the next bite out of that delta. So I do want to talk about success first. And or at least partial success, and that is the gains that the state of Oregon has made, and I should add made in a collaborative way, you know, by stakeholders and the two electric utilities working together. And I mentioned the two electric utilities because we have lots more electric utilities, but they're all basically carbon neutral or very nearly so because their primary resource is hydro. So our issues with utility greenhouse gas emissions go to Portland General Electric and Pacific Power. And Portland General Electric, again, in a negotiated agreement with stakeholders, with DEQ and with EPA, agreed in 2010 that they would operate the Boardman Power Plant for 10 more years, and then they would end coal combustion at that power plant. They did this in part for greenhouse gas management, but in part for dollar management. They actually ended up saving something in the order of $450 million of ratepayer money by agreeing to close the plant and coal operations in 2020 instead of having to do substantial additional emissions mitigation at that plant that would have cost them and their ratepayers, including myself, a lot of money. Senate Bill 1547, which you passed last year, was also a negotiated agreement among stakeholders, the two utilities, and ultimately the state government. And under that, the two utilities agreed that they would end delivery of coal-generated electricity into the state of Oregon by, in Pacific's case, 2030, and Portland General's by 2035. That still leaves a lot of open questions, not the least of which is when the Boardman Power Plant ends coal combustion and creates a need for additional resource on Portland General Electric's part, how is that additional need filled? And is it filled with primarily with new gas combustion or primarily with low or zero carbon resources or some combination of the two? And I will get to that in a little bit greater detail. But that's the big open question that is being discussed within the electric utility community and stakeholders today. Senate Bill 1547 made the change that you see up there. The top graph is where electric utility emissions were headed before Senate Bill 1547. And you can see they were basically headed sideways. They weren't going up in a significant manner until the out years, but they also weren't going down. Once Senate Bill 1547 was negotiated and the legislature agreed to it and passed it, we can see on a combined basis that emissions, particularly right around 2030, drop dramatically. And the two utilities' commitment to meeting their load, at least 50% of their load, with new renewables by 2040 means that there's a reasonable chance to keep those emissions down through 2040, possibly through 2050.
For sure.
Yes.
With 1547, as you well know, the coal generation was not in our state, but yet you're accounting for it in our state. And how did you determine how much electricity we got from the coal generation so that you could add it to our greenhouse gas effect? And a follow-up, and a continuing of that question, how much did Wyoming and Utah and everybody else, how much were they able to deduct because of what we claimed?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, I guess number one, I don't think Wyoming does the kind of greenhouse gas inventorying that we do. In particular, they don't do it the way we do it, which is that we measure all of the greenhouse gases associated that originate within the state of Oregon, except that we also add on to that the greenhouse gases associated with electricity generated outside of the state of Oregon but delivered to consumers here and used here. So we have a kind of a hybrid inventory. Mostly it's emissions from within the state boundaries, but we all, because the coal associated emissions are so substantial, the state made a decision actually prior to my time that they would incorporate those into our inventory as well. We do that. The state of Washington actually does that, but there are a number of other states that don't do that. So
I find it rather interesting, and pardon me for interrupting, sure. I find it rather interesting that we'll take the carbon pollution done out of state, but we won't count our renewables, the dams that we have in state. I just find that remarkable.
Yeah, Senator Olson,
whoever figured that out.
We do count all the electricity that comes from dams, whether it's in state or out of state, but it comes into the state of Oregon, we count that also. But that's essentially zero carbon, so it doesn't add anything to our pile of carbon that we have to deal with.
But when we did the RPS, we said that existing hydro didn't count.
Actually, Senator Olson, I think what we said was that for purposes of the RPS, the objective of that was to develop and acquire new renewables in addition to the hydro. And that, in fact, you know, by the time we hit 2040, if we're meeting half of our load with new renewables, we still should be meeting about 40% of our load with existing hydro renewables, which is going to put us up in the 80 to 90% zero carbon, you know, electrical system range. So believe me, we count that. That's important to where we end up, you know, as an electrical system.
What are we as a percentage of the rest of the United States?
Overall? We are probably a little higher than our sort of population rank, and I'm not sure what our population rank is, but it's probably, what, right in the middle, about 30th or so? 27th, yeah, that's what I thought. So we probably emit more carbon than that in most sectors, but our electrical sector, because of the hydro in it, probably pushes it back in the other direction. I would guess that we are probably a little below 27th in rank for greenhouse gas emissions because of the hydro.
Okay, why don't you continue, Angus?
Okay.
Yeah, I think you're pointing to something that is, you know, it's a broad issue and that we're going to have to, you know, we will be talking about. When our RPS program was created, there were certain assumptions that were made. And, they had to do with where do we need to be to meet our goals, where do we need to be in terms of new power generation as opposed to legacy power generation?
Well, the question I'm asking is how did we determine our goals? Well, because we didn't obviously take into account population increase. We said we're gonna be here no matter how many people we get, and that seems to be a little bit difficult to get to.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, I guess my quick answer to that is once again that from purposes of the impact of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, it doesn't matter how many people there are or what the emissions per capita are. What matters is the total overall emissions. And we do track per capita and per GDP emissions because they tell us something about where we're headed, and in particular, you know, whether we're able to drive emissions down even though our population is increasing and even though our GDP is increasing. And in both of those cases, that is so. We've been able to push emissions down while population has grown and our wealth has grown. And that's good. That's the direction we want to be able to go. So let me go through here and so that we don't keep everybody till midnight on Friday night. So I'm just going to touch on these very briefly. You can see that's the effect of Pacific Power ending coal-generated deliveries to the state of Oregon not later than 2030. And it is a huge drop in our utility emissions. It has a visible impact on overall emissions in the way that closing Boardman, you know, was. It was a noticeable blip, but it was a blip. It wasn't a drop like this. And frankly, we expect, and Pacific Power, I think, also expects that their emissions will actually drop faster than this. They asked for a 2030 date because that gives them more planning flexibility, and we agreed they should have more planning flexibility, but they have already started to close or convert plants in advance of the schedule that they provided when we negotiated this 2030 date. Portland General is a little bit different. As you see, Portland General is kind of like an airplane on a runway, you know, doing touch and goes, as my father, a pilot, used to say. When Boardman closes or ends coal combustion, there is a drop. If PGE replaces Boardman with mostly baseload gas, emissions go back up above the trend line. The next drop you see is when they end coal deliveries from Colstrip in Montana, and it drops down to the trend line again. But again, if as their current integrated resource planning process suggests, they are replacing that with baseload gas, then their emissions go right back up again. So, you know, we have an issue we are working through with Portland General Electric, and I think we're working through it, you know, in a way that, you know, we can't tell where we're going to end up, but it is the kind of cordial negotiations that enabled us to arrive at an agreement on Boardman and on 1547. So stay tuned here. Okay. I want to get into transportation and forests, because those are probably the two most important areas and messages that we can provide to the legislature this time around. And you will remember our recommendation said, do something on greenhouse gas emissions from transportation. Don't, for the time being, do anything on forest carbon. And we'll explain both of those recommendations. Fundamentally, transportation, our largest greenhouse gas sector at about 37%. The Department of Transportation in a stakeholder group that led to something called the State Sustainable Transportation Strategy finished in 2013. We basically concluded that we could get to state 2050 goals at least with light duty vehicles, cars and trucks, if we lowered the carbon content in the fuels, if we accelerated the changeover from internal combustion engines to electric engines, and if those electric vehicles became more and more available and accessible, and the costs, especially the front end costs, came down, if we were able to deploy the recharging infrastructure so that we addressed range anxiety issues, all things that we are actually making some fairly significant progress on. And just incidentally, we had to be able to show that we were plugging these new electric vehicles into a clean grid, not into a coal plant. If we were able to do those things, and we were able to come back and reinvest in substantial ways in transit, both urban transit in places like Lane County and the metro area, and in inner city exurban transit in the rest of the state, that there was a significant, and if we were to, over the next 20 or 30 years, be designing or redesigning our cities so that, in particular, there was increased densities along transit corridors, so that increasingly people were in a position that I'm in, frankly, where I live in Portland, where I never have to move my car during the week. I'm glad I have it. I'm going to keep it. But it, frankly, is easier to get on a bus and go downtown and not pay for parking. And we want to make sure that that's increasingly available to other people, and especially to low-income households. That's a huge benefit for them if they don't have to be on a bus 2 hours coming and 2 hours going to work, or drive a car and pay for parking. So urban design, and then a number of other strategies that are in there, but those are the ones that have to be developed. And in that regard, I just want to observe in passing for you that the transportation memorandum that was released by the joint committee, co-chaired by Senator Beyer and Representative McEwen, is a really useful and interesting piece of paper that doesn't mention greenhouse gases or climate change or global warming once, which is, frankly, an extraordinary I just got this last night, and I read through it looking for, you know, those references in addition to all the other things our transportation sector has got to provide us. And the closest I could come is at the end of every additional issues for consideration is the bullet, what additional issues require attention? That's greenhouse gases. I hope that the commission, that the legislature will look at the numbers that we're providing, look at the challenge in getting to our greenhouse gas goals, and acknowledge, as I should add, organizations like the Oregon Transportation Forum, which we are a part of, have recognized that a transportation bill needs a substantial clean transportation component to it. It needs it. This is just a reiteration of just the transportation greenhouse gas emissions numbers that allows you to see that in the last 2 years or so, our emissions have gone from going down to sideways to back up again.
Angus, before you go on, I have a question on the previous slide. You mentioned the hailing services, you know, Uber and Lyft.
Yes.
How do they help?
This is kind of interesting. You have to sort of forecast some of this, but I've talked to some people a lot smarter about this than I am. And one of the things I said was, you know, if you have a lot of Uber and Lyft vehicles out on the road, on the one hand, they're probably in motion all the time. They're driving all the time because that's how they make money. But they are displacing so many cars that otherwise would have been driven only about 5% of the time, and the rest of the time our cars sit somewhere. They sit in downtown parking. They sit at home. So they've displaced those. That reduces congestion in substantial degree. It also means that for every mile driven by every VMT, every vehicle mile driven, we're actually getting more value in terms of moving more people, more places, in less time. So in essence, you have to think of Uber and Lyft as part of a continuum that on the one hand is a single occupancy vehicle and on the other hand is a max train. And the more we can move, more people find it attractive to move from a single occupancy vehicle along this spectrum to Uber and Lyft and taxi cabs, you know, to drive for hire vehicles like Car2Go, to buses, to transit, to electric transit. The more they move over there, the more emissions go down, the more passenger miles traveled goes up, and the more congestion goes down. So it's basically shifting from everybody in their own car because that's the only convenient option for them, to the people who have to drive or who want to drive keep driving. But we hope they're driving electric vehicles at that point. But increasingly, we give people other options that are both time and fuel and carbon more efficient. And they move that way. That's how it happens.
So is there more of a tendency for people to share Uber rides than, you know,
it's not so much that they're sharing, some are, but it's more that they are sharing the vehicle. And so it's empty less. And it's utilized more. You know, you get the same amount of vehicle miles traveled, but more passenger miles traveled. Just because you have more passengers in that car more often, and they're not single occupancy vehicles for the most part. And as I said, you also achieve less congestion. This is just the chart that I mentioned earlier of where vehicle miles traveled have gone. And you can see a drop after 2000, flattening out, a significant drop in 2007 and 2008. Again, a flattening as the economy, all too slowly was recovering. And now when it's recovering more briskly and fuel prices are lower, we see a significant jump in vehicle miles traveled. This is actually the operative chart from the 2013 Sustainable Transportation Strategy that ODOT developed at the direction of the legislature. And as you can see, the measures that I already described, the transit, the EVs, the urban design, succeed substantially in driving down those light-duty vehicle miles traveled and carbon emissions. The shift over to low-carbon vehicles plus the more efficient system substantially reduces those. We see additional reductions in freight, but not as substantial. And frankly, the freight in particular and the airlines are very dependent on national fuel economy standards, which the Obama administration was aggressive in moving, which the Trump administration may not be as aggressive in moving. So we are very, sensitive to national policy when it comes to vehicle efficiency all the way up and down the line. I'm going to skip over these next two slides. I just put them in to remind us and maybe you that we did a wedge analysis for you in our last report that said, okay, if we've got this big wedge to fill, how do we fill it in? And I just want to observe for you the purple wedge there is electric utilities. That's the one we've taken a fairly significant bite out of. But the orange wedge, which is a much bigger one, is transportation, and that's the one that's growing, not shrinking. So those are the things that we have, just an illustrative things that we have to do to try to take a bite out of transportation. The transportation bill in front of the legislature this year ought to be the vehicle for doing this. And I would just add that the folks who are working on that clean transportation bill have made the same effort in terms of trying to integrate it into overall transportation goals and means and ends that we tried to do in working with the electric utilities on the power plants.
And Gibbs, on the transportation, if we look at that wedge that is transportation, how much are we anticipating that clean fuels will accommodate that?
How much of that would be delivered by clean fuels?
Senator Dembrough, in this project, we incorporated clean fuels into the baseline, so it's actually included in the blue top line there because it was an adopted state policy at that point.
And I do think we have an absolute number for you, but we don't have it at the tip of our tongue. But we can get it. Mm-hmm. Whoops. So this is the other area that I want to make sure we're able to cover here, and I want to cover it in part because in 2010, when my commission did its initial roadmap on how to get to 2020 and 2050, we didn't include a target, a goal for forests, and we didn't do that because we didn't know what any of the numbers were. We knew there was a lot of carbon there, but we didn't know how it flowed. We didn't know how much there was. So in essence, what we said as a recommended policy was leave the West Side public forests alone. They're accruing carbon, although we don't know how fast and how much. Treat the near East Side, especially the Eastern Cascades, the Blues, and the Wallawas, because, frankly, they are the sicker forests, and they have to be nursed back to forest health actively. Before they can be given accruing carbon as a primary responsibility, rely largely on private forest lands for forest product. you know, that was the recommendation of the task force that worked on this for the commission, which was a very diverse task force. But it's not a very satisfactory answer. So last year, we impaneled a task force of advisors from industry, from Oregon State, from the NGO community, from the federal and state forest management agencies, and we said, we know we can do better. In particular, can we start with how much carbon is out there? And we have an answer to that. As far as we know, this is a first in the nation for a state to actually inventory its carbon in its forests. And there's a lot of carbon out there. So just by way of points of comparison, our carbon budget for the state as a whole, excluding forests, is about 60 million tons per year. In our forests, there are about 11 billion tons of carbon dioxide equivalent in the forest. It is a huge differential. Over the period 2001 to 2010, you know, the forest fires in that we have dealt with, you know, which have varied from very intense years to pretty moderate years, on average, they have put out about 1.3 million tons of carbon, you know, per year over that 10-year period. The Boardman power plant by itself puts out about 2 million tons. So the forest fires themselves, you know, were probably two-thirds on average of what the Boardman plant was. It's a lot. And we think, although these numbers are still preliminary, that we are accruing carbon in Oregon forests at a rate of something in the neighborhood of 30 million tons a year. Most of that west side, but not all of it west side. And that number is still to be validated. But at least we have a start. We have some numbers, and we have them not just in total, but we have them by different forest regions, since different forests have different, you know, both ecosystem and carbon characteristics. We have them by ownership, and we now have them also by carbon pool. And what I mean by that is when you look at a forest, you know, the first thing you think of is all those standing trees. And that's a significant carbon pool. But there are also a lot of dead trees out there. Some are natural. Some are a consequence of natural fire. Some are a consequence of accidental or intentionally caused fires in the forest. But they burned. They're still standing. They're charred on the outside. But they still have a lot of carbon left in them, dead tree or not. There is downwood, there's forest floor, the branches and the duff, and by far the largest pool is the soil pool. What we don't know yet, and where we have to get to next, what did I do wrong? Whatever it was, we have laid out with the task force a work plan that we hope will get us to where we can actually describe what's going on with carbon in the forest, not just how much there is, but what flows there are between those different pools within the forest. And if we get that, then we want to know what we expect climate change is liable to do to that total and to those flows. Do we expect a significant increase in either extent or severity of forest fire? Well, we do actually expect an increase in extent. And the jury's still out on increase in severity, how much gets burned per square mile or per acre. But we need to try to understand that and be able to model it so that we can look at forest carbon and decide when we intervene in those forests, what's the carbon consequence and what trade-offs are there? So when I say intervention, I mean, for example, setting fires deliberately to help manage the undergrowth in the forest, thinning, forest health thinning, you know, actual harvest for product, Those are probably the major interventions, but there will probably be some others, like, for example, going after the juniper that has escaped its usual range and is heading out over eastern Oregon grasslands. That's another sort of subpool that we will have to look at. Ultimately, what we want to be able to do is say, for example, if we take product out of the forest, but we build houses with it, and those houses are standing for, pick a number, 50 years on average, what's the carbon consequence of that? It's not one-to-one, but we know we are going to build houses, so we at least ought to know what the consequence is, and we ought to be able to measure that against the overall accumulation of carbon in the forest. We need to net it against that accumulation. If we are looking at forest fires, and especially if we're looking at increased forest fires, what's the consequence of that for the carbon, either accumulation or decline of carbon in the forests? If we take product out and we burn it in a power plant and we generate electricity and we displace gas or coal as a consequence, this is, by the way, a real possibility with Portland General and the Boardman plant, and this actually is a project wearing a different hat, my Bonneville environmental hat, that we are a partner in trying to figure out how to do and whether we can do it. If we are removing fiber from the forest through forest health thinnings, if we're taking out 2-4 6-inch diameter overgrowth in those forests so that we end up with fewer but larger trees and a healthier forest, what's the net carbon effect of that? Because if we take those trees out, we're reducing carbon in the forest. If the trees that remain there are growing better, that accrues carbon in the forest. If we take those small diameter trees and chip them and burn them in the Boardman power plant and displace fossil fuel elsewhere in the system, how do we net all of those against each other? Given the size of this pool, given the importance of those forests, especially to a lot of communities that are looking for other ways to utilize those forests consistent with both forest health and carbon, you know, at least we are on our way. We are sort of one step out of five on our way toward understanding that and making these kinds of choices. And we may well, for example, make the choice. Right now, I would be inclined to do that, of reducing carbon contained in, say, Eastside Cascade forests in order to improve forest health and by reducing the fuel loading in those forests. That's a trade-off that isn't forever, but it might well be for the next 100 years. It would have a real advantageous effect on the forest communities on the east side of the Cascades. So we want to be able to give the legislature actual answers to questions that it may have about how best to manage forests, and if you manage them, you know, can you measure the carbon consequences of the interventions and make a judgment call whether that's a reasonable price to pay? So we're very hopeful that this is the kind of work that, you know, my commission ought to be doing. You know, if we had the resources, we would be doing a lot more of it. But that's probably the most important task we've undertaken in the last 2 or 3 years.
Yeah. Angus, you said that the forest takes in 30 million metric tons. Is that a year?
Yes, we think it's about 30 million, but you know that's really in steps 2 and 3, so that's very preliminary number.
Not absorbing all Oregon's greenhouse gases.
It's
taken it from everywhere.
Well, yes, and you have to think of that separately from the 60 million tons that we already have to deal with, because we still have to that's 60 million tons after whatever we're accrues. So it doesn't offset our greenhouse gas emissions. It adds.
Now you're
to
confusing
them.
Me.
I know.
We charge for carbon that's generated out of state, and we charge it to our bank account, and we've got trees in state that are absorbing carbon, but we don't get credit for their absorption.
Mm-hmm.
It's just there and it's out there randomly, and you don't count it. And you've got 60 million metric tons that we do. But we got 30 million metric tons that are absorbed, and we don't get any credit for the absorption, but we're charged for out-of-state. It, it really doesn't kind of add up. I mean, we are really doing a very good job. If you look at the Paris Accord, they want the U.S. to drop from about 6 billion metric tons down to 4 billion metric tons. And we only put out 60 million metric tons, which is 0.015 of all the carbon that the United States is allowed to put out as per the Paris Accord. So we're doing a really good job. Just that you'd like to see us do a much, much better job.
We have to do a much, much better job. But that said, Senator Olson, we are, I think, in accord on one point here, which is that if we lived in an economically rational carbon management world, you know, we would be charging for carbon that was released, and we would be paying for carbon that was soaked up. And in that kind of a world, Oregon forests could be a real economic benefit to our state, because, you know, in the accounts there, that would mean that we'd be charged for 60 million tons, but we could offset that by 30 million tons that, you know, we'd be paid for. And so the cost of reducing emissions would be cut in half. If we could accrue more than that 30 million tons a year, if we could accrue 60 million tons a year, you know, it would be an economic wash for us. Lamentably, we don't live in that kind of a world. We don't charge for carbon released, and we don't pay for carbon acquired. So we're going to have to wait for the millennium to arrive, or at least the next one.
Well, or at least for this session.
For at least this session.
Yeah, let me say, Angus, you know, I mean, that this is a subject that we're going to be coming back to in this committee in our work on, you know, if we're envisioning some kind of process for pricing carbon, that we also need to be able to receive benefit for any storage that we're able to do through our forests. Now, how that works, I'm sure, is very tricky, but this is obviously an important first step to know just what's out there.
And, Mr. Chairman, it not only can be done, but my foundation has done that. We've worked with EcoTrust and Nature Conservancy and a number of others to try to steer carbon dollars into forests that they are trying to basically rebuild carbon stocks in. Mm-hmm. So it can be done.
Let me ask a question about the burning of the biomass.
Yes.
I mean, if you know, if we were thinning forests and turning them into wood chips and burning them at Boardman, for example, how exactly is that better than burning gas?
It would be better than burning, well, in two ways. One is you have to ask what's happening to, you know, those thinnings right now. And the answer is they're mostly being piled up and burned. So, you know, we're already releasing carbon dioxide from those thinnings. If we in releasing that carbon dioxide could displace gas, then we could net that backed out gas against the emissions from the wood. And in the long run, you know, wood fiber is, you know, a carbon neutral source, but I emphasize in the long run, meaning if you take carbon out of the forest, it can take anywhere from 50 to 150 years to replenish, and we don't have that kind of time. So we want to be careful not to characterize that as a near-term solution, but it could well be a long-term sustainable solution for this state.
Mm-hmm. But you're talking about it within the context of trying to establish or improve forest health.
Yes.
Right? So this is thinning so that there are other trees that can really thrive and capture carbon because they're old enough.
They're old enough. You know, and so you get more capture from the remaining trees, but more important, you get a healthier ecosystem, you know, which is better for the trees, better for other, you know, foliage, better for the animals, better for the fish. I have two more slides. Please, I hope you'll give me time to at least touch on, but
yeah,
after
we,
questions.
We have time.
Okay.
Senator.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Do you have then offset numbers that explain the difference between building a building out of wood and building it out of concrete and steel?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Roblin, the short answer is there are numbers out there, but, you know, there are several different versions of the numbers, and there's a certain amount of dispute over which numbers are the right numbers. And that is why as you see in item five, we're going to try to come up with numbers that we think are defensible and be able to supply those to you. We know that a lot of energy goes into concrete and into steel. You know, we know that that you know wood can wood handled the right way can often last just as long as steel and concrete, given building lives. So we think that we can do a net calculation that is a defensible calculation. I could give you one tomorrow that, or maybe even two or three, but we want to have time to work our way through this issue so that we think we can give you one that is well-grounded and peer-reviewed.
Yes, Senator Olson.
It's interesting. I talked to a gentleman last year about carbon in the forest and how they measure capacity of a tree. Do you have any documentation, any literature, anything you can send me that says that we can measure what a 20-year-old Doug fir tree will absorb as compared to a 50-year-old or 150-year-old Doug fir as compared to a maple or an oak? Because, you know, if you'd look out, and I don't believe that you had the opportunity to look out, but those trees out there have their ear to the window because it's their food we're talking about. But I'm interested in to see how you would measure that and take into context a forest of an acre of forest and then extrapolate that into a million acres of forest to see how much, you know, carbon it uses or absorbs.
So, Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, again, there are numbers. You know, there are sort of multiple numbers. What we will try to do is to, in particular, get numbers for both different age classes of trees and for different kinds of trees. You get a different accrual with a Doug fir than you do with a ponderosa than you do with a lodgepole. And it's further complicated by the fact that the life cycle of each of those trees in forests is different. You know, lodgepole burns more readily and in a more rapid cycle than does ponderosa, than does Doug fir. So it's complicated.
And it depends where they're located.
It depends on... Right, but there's a reason Doug fir are located on the west side from, and ponderosa on the east side and lodgepole down south. But each of them has different life cycle characteristics and therefore different carbon characteristics. And this is why, among other reasons, that the Forest Service, in responding to our requests, came up with those different regions, because those different regions sort of broadly describe different kinds of forest ecosystems with different characteristics. That said, I think we can get you some numbers that would be
helpful
to you.
The gentleman I talked to said there was really not adequate scientific literature to provide exacting numbers as to how much is sort of, because one of the questions I asked him, if we go in and cut a 50-year-old forest and replant that forest where we have a tree every 50 or 60 feet, when we replant it and we put them in every 30 feet, do those trees, new and young and growing, do they absorb equivalent to, less than, or more than the tree that was cut down that these little guys are replacing? So when we go in and do a clear cut, as this grows, this replaces the trees that were lost. What's the net effect of these new growing trees to the trees that were cut, the carbon that they've saved, and the new carbon we're taking in? Because the other question I asked him was, as a tree gets older, does it take more, less carbon or more carbon?
Yeah, and Senator, you've only begun to describe the complexities in trying to measure this. You know, when you plant those trees out in the forest, you know, they are going to respond, you know, not just to a blueprint, but to what the weather is like.
Right.
And you know, we know that there are significant weather and climatic cycles that we go through all the time. It's why tree rings are wide and they're narrow. Trying to measure or model a carbon accrual by a tree holding everything else constant is a tricky exercise. But there certainly are papers on this, I don't think that, frankly, there is a consensus on it at this point. But let us look into it and see what we can find for you.
Okay. It's obviously going to be really important if we enter into some sort of offset market as part of carbon pricing, that you know, we have, you know, real value. I mean, it's not just a con game. It's this is we're seeing real storage happening.
Yes, and Mr. Chairman, apropos Senator Olson's very first question this afternoon about whether these are measured or estimated, in this case, the Forest Service actually went out, walked transepts, and measured the carbon content in those transepts. And they then extrapolated that based on the characteristics of the forest. So I wouldn't pretend that it's precise, but it is, in fact, measured and not just estimated. And that's a significant gain over where we have been. So we're pretty interested in, you know, what this can mean, you know, for the forests, for the state of Oregon, ultimately for carbon markets, if as and when we get there. Okay. I just, as I said, have two more slides. This one, unfortunately, I can get through all too fast. When it comes to adaptation and preparation, the other interesting document that just came out within the last 10 days was the, I think it was the third climate assessment from the Climate Research Institute at Oregon State. And there weren't many new revelations. It's just that it was reciting the litany of flood, drought, snowpack, fire, public health impacts, which we've seen in the first two, and describing how in the time since the second assessment, the literature and the analysis has gotten surer, and the manifestations are sort of less in the test tube and more visible, you know, out in the world. 2015, I'm sure you're aware, you know, was a serious drought year in the state of Oregon. You know, I drive over Santa Ana a lot, and it was really depressing to see Detroit Lake, you know, drawn down to where the Corps would drive it down for flood control, but it stayed down there all summer and into the fall. And you know, the drought impacts in eastern Oregon, you know, have been documented extensively. So we have a lot of issues that we need to start preparing for. You know, we note with applause that the state and the legislature have decided we have to start preparing, you know, in a serious way for the tsunami that almost certainly is going to come, but we don't know when. But we are not doing anything like that for the kind of climate change that we also know is coming. And in this case, we know when, and we know roughly how fast. And we can already measure things like the average date that the snowpack disappears, the extent of the fire season, which starts earlier and runs later. Those things are already measurable, but we really are not doing much of anything about adaptation and preparation. And I say that as someone who participated in the one extra state government-wide exercise back in 2010 that produced the framework for the adaptation framework, which was a good piece of work for its time, but again, not grounded in data for the most part, but rather in, you know, educated judgments by state staff members. And we've done nothing since 2010 as a state. Individual agencies have periodically, when they've had room to do this, done some pretty good work, particularly ODOT and the Health Service. But as a whole, we simply haven't done this work. The commission was going to try to take this up in 2016, but we had a combination of Senate Bill 1547 and then the Forest Carbon Project, and we don't have the bandwidth to do more than that. We don't really have the bandwidth to do that much. But we had to kick adaptation and preparation down the road again. And there will come a time when we'll all be really sorry that we didn't sit down and deal with this in a systematic and accountable way. And that is my last slide, Mr. Chairman, which is basically a set of observations. One is we have aspirational goals. We're not meeting those goals, and they remain aspirational. I don't know that they have to be mandatory, although other states have decided they could be mandatory, or they could be embedded in a carbon cap and trade or a carbon tax as a way to drive those carbon emissions down systematically. We don't do that either. And we really have no accountability within state government for what we are doing or aren't doing. My commission in the 4 years ago put out a report card that said, you know, let's look at the roadmap that the commission developed in 2010. How are we doing sort of task by task? So it wasn't agency specific, it was task specific. And basically, we're doing about C-plus work, and frankly, that's somewhat generous grading on the curve. And even more to the point, we're not grading this on an ABCD basis. This is kind of a pass-fail test, and if you're not passing, you're failing. And really, that's what we're doing right now. We are proposing to the legislature that they try to at least take a modest step in the direction of improving systematic disciplined analysis, you know, of the sort we're trying to do in the forest right now, but we're basically having to do it with no budget whatsoever and, you know, tapping into both stakeholders and state staff to the extent that they don't have prior or preemptive responsibilities. But we can't do very much of that. So we are introducing legislation, or Representative Helms is introducing legislation on the House side that would do two things. One is that it would set up a process by which we the commission can sit down with the state agencies that have a piece of the solution, figure out what their who's got primary responsibility for what. Negotiate with them, work out with them some benchmarks that would describe progress or our failure to make progress, and then ask those state agencies to report to the commission once a year on whether they're making or missing their benchmarks, and in either case, why. The commission wouldn't have any authority over any other state agency other than the authority to request and require that report to be submitted. We would then be in a position to put those data, that information together, and come back to the legislature with a much more systematic report, which says agency by agency, subject by subject, here's where we're making progress, here's where we're not making progress, here's why we're not making progress. I will predict, of course, that in most cases the agencies will say because we didn't have the FTE or we didn't have the budget, but that's a useful bit of information for the legislature to hear when it's making its own budget and FTE trade-offs. So we'd like to set up that system of accountability if the legislature will authorize us to do that. We are also proposing a modest budget of perhaps $500,000 a year that would allow us to have our own, you know, one and a half dedicated FTE. And when I say this, this is not to diminish the above and beyond the call of duty work and product that we get from the Department of Energy, first Bill Drumhiller and now Jessica, but we wear them out. And in any event, for better or worse, they don't have control over their own allocation of time, and their time can be preempted. So we would like to get authority to have one and a half FTE and a small budget that would also allow us to build a two-way communications with the citizens of Oregon, a lot of whom are very concerned about this issue or about the impacts of climate, and we have no way to communicate with them, and a small budget to do our own analysis, particularly, and I finger Representative Bentz in this matter, particularly to be able to do cost-effectiveness analysis so that when we're looking at a range of ways to reduce emissions. Right now we can probably get the amount of emissions reduced, but we don't very systematically can't say we have to put this kind of money into it to get this kind of emission reduction out of it. So our strategies, I think, are good strategies. They are intuitively cost effective, but they are not analytically cost effective, and we'd like to be able to address that issue as well. So that's our report to you. We know you're going to take the text home tonight and, you know, be reading it into the wee hours of the morning. And we will bring answers to the questions that have been raised here back to you. And we hope that it evokes other questions as well. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Angus. I have a quick question about the benchmarking.
Yes.
I feel like I've seen in some of the agency presentations to Ways and Means in their key performance measures some reference to different greenhouse gas related matters. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah, I think you have seen it. Again, it's sort of episodic, and it's, you know, which agency has this on their list that year.
And presumably that's because they have some sort of statutory requirement to report on that. But it's yes. Scattershot.
Yeah, it's scattershot. It's probably more likely that their governing board or commission has charged them with including that kind of a benchmark. But it may also be if they're coming and asking for funding from the legislature to do something, or the legislature tells them to do something, like develop the sustainable transportation strategy, for example, at ODOT, that they will have a budget allocation to do that, and they'll have a benchmark that they need to report back on that they have done it. So it does happen. I would say it's more than random, but less than systematic, and in addition, the agencies are pretty siloed with respect to greenhouse gases and climate impacts. So the Department of Transportation, for example, is not yet, but is going to be looking at the impact of forest fires on the operations of its highway facilities. But it doesn't have any of the fire information, and still less the projected climate-driven fire information that they're going to have. So, you know, those kinds of integration efforts need to take place as well.
Great, thanks. Yes, Senator Olson.
I noticed on your last slide, what you have up there, there isn't any bullet point on there that indicates the cost to Oregonians. What money is going to come out of their pocket to pay for this? Do you take that into account when we look at greenhouse gas and what we have to do to reduce it? Do you take into account what it would cost an Oregonian each year to do this?
So, Sherman, Senator Olson, you're not talking about, in this case, about the budget for a commission. You're talking about the overall cost.
I'm talking about the overall. I didn't see anywhere in there where it says no accountability between state climate policies and priorities and agency actions. I understand that, but I didn't see any discussion whatsoever relating to what Oregonians are going to have to pay.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you did say that that's one of the things you need to be able to do with your expanded capacity.
Yes, is
one of the priorities. Right. Figure out what the cost benefits are.
Right, Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson.
And I heard that the cost benefit, but I didn't hear the cost to Oregonians. If you tell an Oregonian that every year it's going to cost them $1,000 more to reduce carbon, I just wonder if you can make that sale.
Well, I don't know whether we can or not. I rather think we could, at least based on most of the public opinion surveys that I've seen of Oregonians out there. And we know, in particular, in a number of both large and small urban areas, and in some rural areas, that the local government has undertaken climate management and greenhouse gas reduction activities, and been supported in doing that by the majority of their citizens. That said, I think your question is a good one and more to the point, and that is, can we describe how much money we are spending, and in some cases how much money we are saving by reducing greenhouse gas emissions? I will just give you an example. It's not state specific, it's regional. But the electric energy efficiency alone that we acquire as a Pacific Northwest region, and have been doing so since the Northwest Power Act of 1980, you know, today is saving taxpayers across the region $3.5 billion a year in avoided new generation that otherwise would have had to have been developed and paid for. And we're saving all of the greenhouse gases that were not being released because we didn't build coal and gas plants to serve that load. We served it from energy efficiency. That's a gain. You know, there are other circumstances where I think, you know, it's going to be more equivocal. If we are putting more buses on the road, it's costing more money for the buses and for the operations. What kind of a gain are we getting in greenhouse gases from doing that? Although even there, I think we have to be clear that there are lots of other gains we get from transit besides the greenhouse gases. And I gather from at least a couple of committee hearings that I sat in on, and in one case testified to the Joint Transportation Committee when they went out over the state this year, that more transit was a constant theme at every one of the hearings that they put on. And it wasn't always just for greenhouse gases. In fact, it was much more to enable those communities to operate better. In some cases, especially in Eastern Oregon, it was to enable small communities to get to services that were only available in large communities. There are a lot of co-benefits here besides greenhouse gases. But that said, we do want to be able to look at what the greenhouse gas benefit is and what the cost to achieve it is. And then if there are co-benefits, we can describe them, but at least we'll start out with a cost number, and we can give that cost number then to you.
That's great. Okay, one last question.
I think I'm okay.
Yeah.
The one thing that I think you overlook, at least from my perspective, because I'm in the industry to build efficient houses, when you said we save money, and I wholeheartedly believe in conservation, but when you say we save money, when we go to CFLs, it costs a homeowner an additional $2,000 to put CFLs in the house. They don't realize that in the cost. They just look at the price of the house, go, holy smokes, you know, and there are beads of perspiration on their brow. And when we have to do all the new energy efficiency appliances and energy efficiency windows, all these add to the cost that you don't seem to look at when you say we conserve energy. We do conserve energy, but it costs the person quite a large sum of money, up to 20% more for the same home that he got 20 years ago to conserve this energy. And that cost, I don't think, is equated into the formula saying, yes, we have saved this much energy, but this is the cost. Extrapolate it out over 100,000 houses, and you'll see that there is a huge cost to it that isn't taken into account. That's the point I'm trying to make.
Sure. Senator Olson.
The fact that people don't see it.
Yeah, and Senator Olson, it's a good point, but as luck would have it, you're talking to a homeowner, and I can tell you from my perspective as a homeowner, who has retrofit his houses over the last two or three of them in significant ways with weatherization and better lighting. You know, if I can roll those costs into my mortgage, then the incremental cost every month that I pay, you know, is or should be equal to or less than the savings I'm getting from those CFLs or those LEDs or that weatherization in the walls. And this has been a basic precept of energy efficiency, of building energy efficiency, since I started working in it back in the late 70s, early 80s, that we're not talking about asking people to spend money that they can't recover. You know, all of our energy efficiency investments in this region have been energy efficiency investments that pay for themselves, that are by definition cost effective. And that's why I could cite that $3.5 billion savings figure. That is net of the costs of putting those measures into the homes. The big issue, and this is where I thought you were going, is the first cost issue. It's the, if you go into a refrigerator store, there's one refrigerator that costs you $600 to buy and $100 a month to operate. I'm exaggerating slightly here. Let's say $30 a month to operate. There's one right next to it that costs you $900 and, you know, $15 to operate. Are you willing to put out the extra $200, which you'll probably recover with most of those refrigerators within the first, you know, 2, 3, 4 years of operating the refrigerator? Well, you know, especially for low-income households, that's frequently too high a hill to climb. because they can't finance the refrigerator. But with retrofit measures into houses or new measures into new houses, that stuff you can pile into your mortgage, and then you can end up saving that money and not being hit with a cash flow issue, which is even better for low-income houses.
On the assumption you live there longer than the life of the appliance that you have in there.
Or the assumption that when you sell that house, you sell it as an energy efficiency house, an efficient house, and you capture the additional value in the price of the house. That's how I do it anyway.
Well, I would just make one observation. 900 and 600 is not a $200 difference. So you better check your math when you're doing your taxes.
See, that's why we need this 1.5 FTE.
That's right. Okay.
And some money to buy some calculators.
There you go. Thank you.
Okay, great.
Very nice presentation.
Well, thank you very much, Angus and Jessica, for all the work that went into this, obviously. Forget about the presentation. It's going to be very, very useful. And the presentation was very good as well.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much. And I would also like to acknowledge this may be the last time Jessica appears before you because she got a better offer and a pretty interesting one, too. So I'm going to have to break in somebody new, but I do want to acknowledge especially what she and the folks at DEQ and ODF and others have done by way of assisting this commission in, well, it's basic mathematics for one thing, but also just in working through these complicated issues and in particular for bringing our data to where they are no longer 4 and 5 years old, but in some cases 6 months. It's a huge gain. Jessica gets a lot of the credit for it.
That's great. Yeah, Jessica, I'll want to hear more about where you're going. Jessica and I met when I first became chair of this committee in my previous iteration when she was employed by a foreign government doing very interesting work.
That's true.
Okay, very good.
Thank
colleagues,
you.
Thank you very much. Close the informational meeting. We are adjourned until next Monday.